she said gravely. Their eyes met. It was a genuine, tender moment, and it made Big Jim feel like tearing his hair out. He knew he wasn't supposed to let such feelings grip him. It was bad for his blood pressure, and what was bad for his blood pressure was bad for his heart. But it was hard sometimes, especially when you'd just been handed a note from a fellow who knew far too much and now believed God wanted him to speak to the town. If Big Jim was right about what had gotten into Coggins' head, this current business was piddling by comparison. Only it might not be piddling, because Brenda Perkins had never liked him, and Brenda Perkins was the widow of a man who was now perceived in town, for absolutely no good reason, as a hero. The first thing he had to do, "Come on inside," he said. "We'll talk in the conference room." His eyes flicked to Barbie. "Are you part of this, Mr. Barbara? Because I can't for the life of me understand why." "This may help," Barbie said, holding out the sheets of paper they'd been passing around. "I used to be in the Army. I was a lieutenant. It seems that I've had my term of service extended. I've also been given a promotion." Rennie took the sheets, holding them by the corner as if they might be hot. The letter was considerably more elegant than the grubby note Richie Killian had handed him, and from a rather more well-known correspondent. The heading read simply, "From the White House." It bore today's date. Rennie felt the paper. A deep vertical crease had formed between his bushy eyebrows. "This isn't White House stationery." "Of course it is, you silly man," Barbie was tempted to say. "It was delivered an hour ago by a member of the FedEx Elf Squad. Crazy little fucker just teleported through the dome, no problem." "No, it's not." Barbie tried to keep his voice pleasant. "It came by way of the internet as a PDF file. Miss Shumway downloaded it and printed it out." "Julia Shumway. Another troublemaker."
"Read it, James," Brenda said quietly. "It's important."
Big Jim read it.
4.
Benny Drake, Nori Calvert, and Scarecrow Joe McClatchy stood outside the offices of the Chester's Mill Democrat. Each had a flashlight. Benny and Joe held theirs in their hands. Nori's was tucked into the wide front pocket of her hoodie. They were looking up the street at the town hall, where several people, including all three selectmen and the cook from Sweetbriar Rose, appeared to be having a conference.
"I wonder what that's about," Nori said.
"Grown-up shit," Benny said, with a supreme lack of interest, and knocked on the door of the newspaper office. When there was no response, Joe pushed past him and tried the knob. The door opened. He knew at once why Ms. Shumway hadn't heard them. Her copier was going full blast while she talked with the paper's sports reporter and the guy who had been taking pictures out of the field day. She saw the kids and waved them in. Single sheets were shooting rapidly in the copier's tray. Pete Freeman and Tony Gay were taking turns pulling them out and stacking them up.
"There you are," Julia said. "I was afraid you kids weren't coming. We're almost ready. If the damn copier doesn't shit the bed, that is."
Joe, Benny, and Nori received this enchanting bon mot with silent appreciation, each resolving to put it to use as soon as possible.
"Did you get permission from your folks?" Julia asked. "I don't want a bunch of angry parents on my neck."
"Yes, ma'am," Nori said. "All of us did."
Freeman was tying up a bundle of sheets with twine. "Doing a bad job of it, too," Nori observed.
She herself could tie 5 different knots.
Also fishing flies.
Her father had shown her.
She, in turn, had shown him how to do nosies on her rail. And when he fell off the first time, he laughed until tears rolled down his face. She thought she had the best dad in the universe.
"Want me to do that?" Nori asked.
"If you can do a better job, sure." Pete stood aside. She started forward, Joe and Benny crowding close behind her. Then she saw the big black headline on the one sheet extra and stopped.
"Holy shit!"
As soon as the words were out, she clapped her hands to her mouth, but Julia only nodded.
"It's an authentic holy shit, all right. I hope you all brought bikes, and I hope they all have baskets. You can't haul these around town on skateboards."
"That's what you said. That's what we brought," Joe replied. "Mine doesn't have a basket, but it's got a carrier."
"And I'll tie his load on for him," Nori said.
Pete Freeman, who was watching with admiration as the girl quickly tied up the bundles, with what looked like a sliding butterfly, said, I bet you will. Those are good.
Yeah, I rock, Nori said matter-of-factly. Got flashlights? Julia asked.
Yes, they all said together.
Good. The Democrat hasn't used newsboys in 30 years, and I don't want to celebrate the reintroduction of the practice with one of you getting hit on the corner of Main or Prestille.
That would be a bummer, all right, Joe agreed.
Every house and business on those two streets gets one, right? Plus Morin and St. Anne Avenue. After that, spread out. Do what you can, but when it gets to be 9 o'clock, go on home. Drop any leftover papers on street corners, put a rock on them to hold them down.
Benny looked at the headline again. Chester's Mill, attention. Explosives to be fired at barrier. Cruise missile delivery system. Western border evacuation recommended.
I bet this won't work, Joe said darkly, examining the map, obviously hand-drawn, at the bottom of the sheet. The border between Chester's Mill and Tarker's Mills had been highlighted in red. There was a black X where Little Bitch Road cut across the town line. The X had been labeled Point of Impact.
Bite your tongue, kiddo, Tony Gay said.
5.
From the White House. Greetings and salutations to the Chester's Mill Board of Selectmen. Andrew Sanders, James P. Rennie, Andrea Grinnell. Dear sirs and madam, first and foremost I send you greetings and want to express our nation's deep concern and good wishes. I have designated tomorrow as a national day of prayer. Across America, churches will be open as people of all faiths pray for you and for those working to understand and reverse what has happened at the borders of your town. Let me assure you that we will not rest until the people of Chester's Mill are freed and those responsible for your imprisonment are punished. That this situation will be resolved, and soon, is my promise to you and to the people of Chester's Mill. I speak with all the solemn weight of my office as your commander-in-chief. 2. This letter will introduce Colonel Dale Barbara of the U.S. Army. Colonel Barbara served in Iraq, where he was awarded the Bronze Star, a Merit Service Medal, and 2 Purple Hearts. He has been recalled to duty and promoted so that he may serve as your conduit to us and ours to you. I know that, as loyal Americans, you will afford him every assistance. As you aid him, so will we aid you. My original intent, in accordance with the advice given me by the Joint Chiefs and the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security, was to invoke martial law in Chester's Mill and appoint Colonel Barbara as interim military governor. Colonel Barbara has assured me, however, that this will not be necessary. He tells me he expects full cooperation from selectmen and local police. He believes his position should be one of advise and consent. I have agreed to his judgment, subject to review. 3, I know you are worried about your inability to call friends and loved ones. We understand your concern, but it is imperative that we maintain this telephonic blackout to lower the risk of classified information passing into and out of Chester's Mill. You may think this a specious concern. I assure you, it is not. It may very well be that someone in Chester's Mill has information regarding the barrier surrounding your town. In-town calls should go through. 4, we will continue to maintain a press blackout for the time being, although this matter will remain subject to review. There may come a time when it would be beneficial for town officials and Colonel Barbara to hold a press conference. But at present our belief is that a speedy end to this crisis will render such a meeting with the press moot. My 5th point concerns internet communications. The Joint Chiefs are strongly in favor of a temporary blackout on email communications, and I was inclined to agree. Colonel Barbara, however, has argued strongly in favor of allowing the citizens of Chester's Mill continued internet access. He points out that email traffic can be legally monitored by the NSA, and as a practical matter, such communications can be vetted more easily than cell transmissions. Since he is our man on the spot, I have agreed to this point, partly on humanitarian grounds. This decision, however, will also be subject to review, changes in policy may occur. Colonel Barbara will be a full participant in such reviews, and we look forward to a smooth working relationship between him and all town officials. Sixth, I offer you the strong possibility that your ordeal may end as early as tomorrow at 1 p.m. EDT. Colonel Barbara will explain the military operation that will occur at that time, and he assures me that between the good offices of yourselves and Ms. Julia Shumway, who owns and operates the local newspaper, you will be able to inform the citizens of Chester's Mill what to expect. And last, you are citizens of the United States of America, and we will never abandon you. Our firmest promise, based on our finest ideals, is simple. No man, woman, or child left behind. Every resource we need to employ in order to end your confinement will be employed. Every dollar we need to spend will be spent. What we expect from you in return is faith and cooperation. Please give us both. With every prayer and every good wish, I remain most sincerely yours. 6. Whatever scribble-dee-dee dog's body might have written it, the bastard had signed it himself, and using all three of his names, including the terrorist one in the middle. Big Jim hadn't voted for him, and at this moment, had he teleported into existence in front of him, Rennie felt he could cheerfully have strangled him. And Barbara. Big Jim's fondest wish was that he could whistle up Pete Randolph and have Colonel Fry Cook slammed into a cell. Tell him he could run his gosh darned martial law command from the basement of the cop shop with Sam Verdreau serving as his aide-de-camp. Maybe Sloppy Sam could even hold the DTs at bay long enough to salute without sticking his thumb in his eye. But not now. Not yet. Certain phrases from the Blackguard and Chief's letter stood out. As you aid him, so will we aid you. A smooth working relationship with all town officials. This decision will be subject to review. What we expect is faith and cooperation. That last one was the most telling. Big Jim was sure the pro-abortion son of a buck knew nothing about faith. To him, it was just a buzzword. But when he spoke of cooperation, he knew exactly what he was saying. And so did Jim. It's a velvet glove, but don't forget the iron fist inside it. The president offered sympathy and support. He saw the drug-addled Grinnell woman actually tear up as she read the letter. But if you look between the lines, you saw the truth. It was a threat letter, pure and simple. Cooperate, or you lose your internet. Cooperate, because we'll be making a list of who's naughty and who's nice. And you don't want to be on the naughty side of the ledger when we break through. Because we will remember. Cooperate, pal. Or else. Rennie thought, I will never turn my town over to a short-order cook who dared to lay a hand on my son and then dared to challenge my authority. That will never happen, you monkey. Never. He also thought, softly, calmly, let Colonel Fry Cook explain the military's big plan. If it worked, fine. If it didn't, the U.S. Army's newest colonel was going to discover whole new meanings to the phrase deep in enemy territory. Big Jim smiled and said, let's go inside, shall we? Seems we have a lot to talk about. 7. Junior sat in the dark with his girlfriends. It was strange. Even he thought so. But it was also soothing. When he and the other new deputies had gotten back to the police station after the colossal fuck-up in Dinsmore's Field, Stacy Moggin, still in uniform herself and looking tired, had told them they could have another 4 duty hours if they wanted. There was going to be plenty of overtime on offer, at least for a while, and when it came time for the town to pay, Stacy said she was sure there'd be bonuses as well, probably provided by a grateful United States government. Carter, Mel, Georgia Rue, and Frank de Lesseps had all agreed to work the extra hours. It wasn't really the money. They were getting off on the job. Junior was, too, but he'd also been hatching another of his headaches. This was depressing after feeling absolutely tip-top all day. He told Stacy he'd pass if that was all right. She assured him it was, but reminded him he was scheduled back on duty tomorrow at 7 o'clock.
"There'll be plenty to do," she said.
On the steps, Frankie hitched up his belt and said,
"I think I'll swing by Angie's house. She probably went someplace with Dodie, but I'd hate to think she slipped in the shower, that she's lying there all paralyzed or something."
Junior felt a throb go through his head. A small white spot began to dance in front of his left eye. It seemed to be jigging and jagging with his heartbeat, which had just speeded up. "I'll go by if you want," he told Frankie. "It's on my way."
"Really? You don't mind?"
Junior shook his head. The white spot in front of his eye darted crazily, sickeningly when he did. Then it settled again. Frankie lowered his voice.
"Sammy Bushy gave me some lip
out at the field day."
"That hole," Junior said.
"No doubt." She goes, "What are you going to do? Arrest me?"
Frankie raised his voice to a snarky falsetto that scraped Junior's nerves. The dancing white spot actually seemed to turn red, and for a moment he considered putting his hands around his old friend's neck and choking the life out of him so that he, Junior, would never have to be subjected to that falsetto again.
"What I'm thinking," Frankie continued, "is I might go out there after I'm off. Teach her a lesson, you know, respect your local police."
"She's a skank. Also, a lesberini."
"That might make it even better."
Frankie had paused, looking toward the weird sunset.
"This dome thing could have an upside. We can do pretty much whatever we want.
For the time being, anyway."
"Consider it, chum."
Frankie squeezed his crotch.
"Sure," Junior had replied, "but I'm not particularly horny."
Except now he was. Well, sort of. It wasn't like he was going to fuck them or anything, but...
"But you're still my girlfriends,"
Junior said in the darkness of the pantry. He'd used a flashlight at first, but then had turned it off. The dark was better.
"Aren't you?"
They didn't reply. If they did, Junior thought, I'd have a major miracle to report to my dad and Reverend Coggins. He was sitting against a wall lined with shelves of canned goods. He had propped Angie on his right and Dodie on his left. Menagerie a trios, as they said in the penthouse forum. His girls hadn't looked too good with the flashlight on, their swollen faces and bulging eyes only partially obscured by their hanging hair. But once he turned it off, hey, they could have been a couple of live chicks. Except for the smell, that was. A mixture of old shit and decay just starting to happen. But it wasn't too bad because there were other more pleasant smells in here. Coffee, chocolate, molasses, dried fruit, and maybe brown sugar. Also a faint aroma of perfume. Dodie's? Angie's? He didn't know. What he knew was that his headache was better again, and that disturbing white spot had gone away. He slid his hand down and cupped Angie's breast.
"You don't mind me doing that, do you, Ange? I mean, I know you're Frankie's girlfriend, but you guys sort of broke up, and hey, it's only copping a feel. Also, I hate to tell you this, but I think he's got cheating on his mind tonight."
He groped with his free hand, found one of Dodie's. It was chilly, but he put it on his crotch anyway.
"Oh my, Dodes," he said. "That's pretty bold. But you do what you feel, girl. Get down with your bad self."
He'd have to bury them, of course, soon. The dome was apt to pop like a soap bubble, or the scientists would find a way to dissolve it. When that happened, the town would be flooded with investigators, and if the dome stayed in place, there would likely be some sort of food-finding committee going house to house looking for supplies. Soon. But not right now. Because this was soothing. Also sort of exciting. People wouldn't understand, of course, but they wouldn't have to understand, because...
"This is our secret," Junior whispered in the dark. "Isn't it, girls?"
They did not reply. Although they would, in time. Junior sat with his arms around the girls he had murdered, and at some point, he drifted off to sleep. 8. When Barbie and Brenda Perkins left the town hall at 11, the meeting was still going on. The two of them walked down Main to Morin without speaking much at first. There was still a small stack of the Democrat one-page extras on the corner of Main and Maple. Barbie slid one out from beneath the rock anchoring the pile. Brenda had a penlight in her purse and shone the beam on the headline. "Seeing it in print should make it easier to believe, but it doesn't," she said. "No," he agreed. "You and Julia collaborated on this to make sure James couldn't cover it up," she said. "Isn't that so?" Barbie shook his head. "He wouldn't try because it can't be done. When that missile hits, it's going to make one hell of a bang. Julia just wanted to make sure Rennie doesn't get to spin the news his way, whatever way that might be." He tapped the one sheet. "To be perfectly blunt, I see this as insurance. Selectman Rennie's got to be thinking, if he was ahead of me on this, what other information is he ahead of me on? James Rennie can be a very dangerous adversary, my friend." They began walking again. Brenda folded the paper and tucked it under her arm. "My husband was investigating him." "For what?" "I don't know how much to tell you," she said. "The choices seem to come down to all or nothing. And Howie had no absolute proof. That's one thing I do know. Although he was close." "This isn't about proof," Barbie said. "It's about me staying out of jail if tomorrow doesn't go well. If what you know might help me with that." "If staying out of jail is the only thing you're worried about, I'm disappointed in you." It wasn't all, and Barbie guessed the widow Perkins knew it. He had listened carefully at the meeting, and although Rennie had taken pains to be at his most ingratiating and sweetly reasonable, Barbie had still been appalled. He thought that beneath the goshes and gollies and doggonets, the man was a raptor. He would exert control until it was wrested from him. He would take what he needed until he was stopped. That made him dangerous for everybody, not just for Dale Barbara. "Mrs. Perkins. Brenda, remember?" "Brenda, right. Put it this way, Brenda. If the dome stays in place, this town is going to need help from someone other than a used car salesman with delusions of grandeur. I can't help anybody if I'm in the Calabozo." "What my husband believed is that Big Jim was helping himself." "How, to what, and how much?" She said, "Let's see what happens with the missile. If it doesn't work, I'll tell you everything. If it does, I'll sit down with the county attorney when the dust settles. And in the words of Ricky Ricardo, James Rennie will have some splainin' to do." "You're not the only one waiting to see what happens with the missile. Tonight, butter wouldn't melt in Rennie's mouth. If the cruise bounces off instead of punching through, I think we may see his other side." She snapped off the penlight and looked up. "See the stars," she said. "So bright. There's the Dipper. Cassiopeia. The Great Bear. All just the same. I find that comforting, do you?" "Yes." They said nothing for a little while, only looked up at the glimmering sprawl of the Milky Way. "But they always make me feel very small and very, very brief." She laughed, then said rather timidly, "Would you mind if I took your arm, Bobby?" "Not at all." She grasped his elbow. He put his hand over hers. Then he walked her home. 9. Big Jim adjourned the meeting at 11:20. Peter Randolph bade them all good night and left. He planned to start the evacuation on the west side of town at 7 a.m. sharp, and hoped to have the entire area around Little Bitch Road clear by noon. Andrea followed, walking slowly with her hands planted in the small of her back. It was a posture with which they had all become familiar. Although his meeting with Lester Coggins was very much on his mind, and sleep, he wouldn't mind getting a little damn sleep, Big Jim asked her if she could stay behind a moment or two. She looked at him questioningly. Behind him, Andy Sanders was ostentatiously stacking files and putting them back in the gray steel cabinet. "And close the door," Big Jim said pleasantly. Now looking worried, she did as he asked. Andy went on doing the end-of-meeting housework, but his shoulders were hunched, as if against a blow. Whatever it was Jim wanted to talk to her about, Andy knew already. And judging by his posture, it wasn't good.
"What's on your mind, Jim?" she asked.
"Nothing serious," which meant it was. "But it did seem to me, Andrea, that you were getting pretty chummy with that Barbara fellow before the meeting. With Brenda, too, for that matter."
"Brenda, that's just..." She started to say ridiculous, but that seemed a little strong. "Just silly. I've known Brenda for 30 years.
"And Mr. Barbara for 3 months, if, that is, eating a man's waffles and bacon is a basis for knowing him."
"I think he's Colonel Barbara now."
Big Jim smiled. Hard to take that seriously when the closest thing he can get to a uniform is a pair of blue jeans and a t-shirt.
"You saw the president's letter."
"I saw something Julia Shumway could have composed in her own gosh darn computer. Isn't that right, Andy?"
"Right,"
Andy said without turning around. He was still filing, and then refiling what he'd already filed, from the look of it. "I suppose it was from the president," Big Jim said. The smile she hated was spreading on his broad, jowly face. Andrea observed with some fascination that she could see stubble on those jowls, maybe for the first time, and she understood why Jim was always so careful to shave. The stubble gave him a sinister Nixonian look.
"Well?"
Worry was now edging into fright. She wanted to tell Jim she'd only been being polite, but it had actually been a little more, and she guessed Jim had seen that. He saw a great deal.
"Well, he is the commander-in-chief, you know."
Big Jim made a pshaw gesture. "Do you know what a commander is, Andrea? I'll tell you. Someone who merits loyalty and obedience because he can provide the resources to help those in need. It's supposed to be a fair trade."
"Yes," she said eagerly. "Resources like that cruiser missile thing."
"And if it works, that's all very fine."
"How could it not? He said it might have a 1,000-pound warhead."
"Considering how little we know about the dome, how can you or any of us be sure? How can we be sure it won't blow the dome up and leave nothing but a mile deep crater where Chester's mill used to be?" She looked at him in dismay, hands in the small of her back, rubbing and kneading at the place where the pain lived. "Well, that's in God's hands," he said. "And you're right, Andrea. It may work, but if it doesn't, we're on our own. And a commander-in-chief who can't help his citizens isn't worth a squirt of warm pee in a cold chamber pot, as far as I'm concerned. If it doesn't work, and if they don't blow all of us to glory, somebody is going to have to take hold in this town. Is it going to be some drifter the president taps with his magic wand, or is it going to be the elected officials already in place? Do you see where I'm going with this?"
"Colonel Barbara seemed very capable to me," she whispered.
"Stop calling him that," Big Jim shouted.
Andy dropped a file, and Andrea took a step backward, uttering a squeak of fear as she did so. Then she straightened, momentarily recovering some of the Yankee steel that had given her the courage to run for selectman in the first place.
"Don't you yell at me, Jim Rennie. I've known you since you were cutting out Sears catalog pictures in the first grade and pasting them on construction paper. So don't you yell."
"Oh, gosh, she's offended." The fierce smile now spread from ear to ear, lifting his upper face into an unsettling mask of jollity. "Isn't that too cotton-picking bad? But it's late and I'm tired and I've handed out about all the sweet syrup I can manage for one day. So you listen to me now and don't make me repeat myself." He glanced at his watch. "It's 11:35 and I want to be home by midnight."
"I don't understand what you want of me."
He rolled his eyes as if he couldn't believe her stupidity. "In a nutshell, I want to know you're going to be on my side, mine and Andy's, if this harebrained missile idea doesn't work. Not with some dishwashing Johnny-come-lately." She squared up her shoulders and let go of her back. She managed to meet his eyes, but her lips were trembling.
"And if I think Colonel Barbara, Mr. Barbara, if you prefer, is better qualified to manage things in a crisis situation?"
"Well, I have to go with Jiminy Cricket on that one," Big Jim said. Let your conscience be your guide. His voice had dropped to a murmur that was more frightening than his shout had been. But there's those pills you take. Those Oxycontins. Andrea felt her skin go cold.
What about them?
Andy's got a pretty good supply put aside for you, but if you were to back the wrong horse in this here race, those pills just might disappear. Isn't that right, Andy?
Andy had begun washing out the coffee maker. He looked unhappy, and he wouldn't meet Andrea's brimming eyes. But there was no hesitation in his reply.
Yes, he said. In a case like that, I might have to turn them down the pharmacist's toilet. Dangerous to have drugs like that around with the town cut off and all.
You can't do that, she cried. I have a prescription.
Big Jim said kindly. The only prescription you need is sticking with the people who know this town best, Andrea. For the present, it's the only kind of prescription that will do you any good.
Jim, I need my pills.
She heard the whine in her voice, so much like her mother's during the last bad years when she'd been bedridden and hated it.
I need them.
I know, Big Jim said. God has burdened you with a great deal of pain. Not to mention a big old monkey on your back, he thought.
Just do the right thing, Andy said.
His dark circled eyes were sad and earnest.
Jim knows what's best for the town, always has. We don't need some outsider telling us our business.
If I do, will I keep getting my pain pills?
Andy's face lit in a smile.
You betcha. I might even take it on myself to up the dosage a little. Say 100 milligrams more a day. Couldn't you use it? You look awfully uncomfortable.
I suppose I could use a little more,
Andrea said dully. She lowered her head. She hadn't taken a drink, not even a glass of wine, since the night of the senior prom when she'd gotten so sick. Had never smoked a joint, had never even seen cocaine except on TV. She was a good person. A very good person. So how had she gotten into a box like this? By falling while she was going to get the mail? Was that all it took to turn someone into a drug addict? If so, how unfair. How horrible.
But only 40 milligrams, 40 more would be enough, I think.
Are you sure? Big Jim asked. She didn't feel sure at all. That was the devil of it.
Maybe 80, she said, and wiped the tears from her face. And in a whisper, you're blackmailing me.
The whisper was low, but Big Jim heard it. He reached for her. Andrea flinched, but Big Jim only took her hand. Gently. No, he said. That would be a sin. We're helping you. And all we want in return is for you to help us.
10. There was a thud. It brought Sammy wide awake in bed, even though she'd smoked half a dube and drunk 3 of Phil's beers before falling out at 10 o'clock. She always kept a couple of 6s in the fridge and still thought of them as Phil's beers, although he'd been gone since April. She'd heard rumors that he was still in town, but discounted them. Surely if he was still around, she would have seen him sometime during the last 6 months, wouldn't she? It was a small town, just like that song said. Thud. That got her bolt upright and listening for little Walter's wail. It didn't come, and she thought, oh, God, that damn crib fell apart, and if he can't even cry. She threw the covers back and ran for the door. She smacked into the wall to the left of it instead. Almost fell down. Damn dark, damn power company. Damn Phil going off and leaving her like this. With no one to stick up for her when guys like Frank the Lesseps were mean to her and scared her and... Thud. She felt along the top of the dresser and found the flashlight. She turned it on and hurried out the door. She started to turn left into the bedroom where little Walter slept, but the thud came again. Not from the left, but from straight ahead. Across the cluttered living room. Someone was at the trailer's front door. And now there came muffled laughter.
Whoever it was sounded like they had their drink on. She strode across the room, the t-shirt she slept in rippling around her chubby thighs. She'd put on a little weight since Phil left, about 50 pounds, but when this dome shit was over, she intended to get on Nutrisystem, return to her high school weight, and threw open the door. Flashlights, 4 of them, and high-powered, hit her in the face. From behind them came more laughter. One of those laughs was more of a nyuk, 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 like Curly and the Three Stooges. She recognized that one, having heard it all through high school. Mel Searles.
"Look at you," Mel said, "all dressed up and no one to blow."
More laughter. Sammy raised an arm to shield her eyes, but it did no good. The people behind the flashlights were just shapes, but one of the laughers sounded female. That was probably good.
"Turn off those lights before I go blind, and shut up, you'll wake the baby."
More laughter, louder than ever, but 3 of the 4 lights went out. She trained her own flashlight out the door and wasn't comforted by what she saw. Frankie DeLesseps and Mel Searles flanking Carter Thibodeau and Georgia Rue. Georgia, the girl who'd put her foot on Sammy's tit that afternoon and called her a dyke. A female, but not a safe female. They were wearing their badges, and they were indeed drunk.
"What do you want? It's late."
"Want some dope," Georgia said. "You sell it, so sell some to us."
"I want to get high as apple pie in a red dirt sky," Mel said, and then laughed. "Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk."
"I don't have any," Sammy said.
"Bullshit. The place reeks of it," Carter said. "Sell us some. Don't be a bitch."
"Yeah,"
Georgia said. In the light of Sammy's flash, her eyes had a silvery glitter.
"Never mind that we're cops."
They all roared at this. They would wake the baby for sure.
"No."
Sammy tried to shut the door. Thibodeau pushed it open again. He did it with just the flat of his hand. Easy as could be. But Sammy went stumbling backward. She tripped over little Walter's goddamn choo-choo and went down on her ass for the second time that day. Her t-shirt flew up.
"Ooh, pink underwear. Are you expecting one of your girlfriends?"
Georgia asked, and they all roared again. The flashlights that had gone out now came back on, spotlighting her. Sammy yanked the t-shirt down almost hard enough to rip the neck. Then she got unsteadily to her feet, the flashlight beams dancing up and down her body.
"Be a good hostess and invite us in," Frankie said, barging through the door.
"Thank you very much." His light flashed around the living room.
"What a pigsty."
"Pigsty for a pig,"
Georgia bellowed, and they all broke up again.
"If I was Phil, I might come back out of the woods just long enough to kick your fucking ass."
She raised her fist. Carter Thibodeau knuckle-dapped her. "He still hiding out at the radio station?" Mel asked. "Tweaking the rock? Getting all paranoid for Jesus?"
"I don't know what you..."
She wasn't mad anymore, only afraid. This was the disconnected way people talked in the nightmares that came if you smoke weed dusted with PCP.
"Phil's gone."
Her 4 visitors looked at each other, then laughed. Searle's idiotic nyuk, nyuk, nyuk rode above the others.
"Gone. Bugged out," Frankie crowed.
"Fucking as if," Carter replied. And then they bumped knucks. Georgia grabbed a bunch of Sammy's paperbacks off the top shelf of the bookcase and looked through them.
"Nora Roberts, Sandra Brown, Stephanie Meyer. You read this stuff? Don't you know fucking Harry Potter rules?"
She held the books out, then opened her hands and dropped them on the floor. The baby still hadn't awakened. It was a miracle.
"If I sell you some dope, will you go?"
Sammy asked.
"Sure," Frankie said. "And hurry up," Carter said. "We got an early call tomorrow. Evacuation details, so shag that fat ass of yours."
"Wait here."
She went into the kitchenette and opened the freezer. Warm now. Everything would be thawed for some reason that made her feel like crying. And took out one of the gallon baggies of dope she kept in there. There were 3 others. She started to turn around, but someone grabbed her before she could. And someone else plucked the baggie from her hand.
"I want to check out that pink underwear again," Mel said in her ear. "See if you got Sunday on your ass."
He yanked her shirt up to her waist.
"Nope, guess not."
Stop it, quit it.
Mel laughed.
Nyak, nyak, nyak.
A flashlight stabbed her in the eyes, but she recognized the narrow head behind it. Frankie de Lesseps.
You gave me lip today, he said. Plus, you slapped me and hurt my little Hanny. And all I did was this.
He reached out and grabbed her breast again. She tried to jerk away. The beam of light that had been trained on her face tilted momentarily up to the ceiling. Then it came down again fast. Pain exploded in her head. He had hit her with his flashlight.
Ow, ow, that hurts, stop it.
Shit, that didn't hurt. You're just lucky I don't arrest you for pushing dope. Stand still if you don't want another one.
This dope smells skanky, Mel said in a matter-of-fact voice. He was behind her, still holding up her shirt.
So does she, Georgia said.
Gotta confiscate the weed, biatch, Carter said. Sorry.
Frankie had glommed onto her breast again. Stand still, he pinched the nipple.
Just stand still.
His voice roughening, his breathing quickening. She knew where this was going. She closed her eyes. Just as long as the baby doesn't wake up, she thought. And as long as they don't do more. Do worse.
Go on, Georgia said. Show her what she's been missing since Phil left.
Frankie gestured into the living room with his flashlight. Get on the couch and spread 'em.
Do you want to read her rights first? Mel asked and laughed. Nyak, nyak, nyak.
Sammy thought if she had to hear that laugh one more time, her head would split wide open. But she started for the couch, head down, shoulders slumped. Carter grabbed her on the way by, turned her, and sprayed the beam of his flashlight up his own face, turning it into a goblin mask.
Are you going to talk about this, Sammy?
No.
The goblin mask nodded.
You hold that thought. Because no one would believe you anyway. Except for us, of course, and then we'd have to come back and really fuck you up.
Frankie pushed her onto the couch.
Do her, Georgia said excitedly, training her light on Sammy.
Do that bitch.
All three of the young men did her. Frankie went first, whispering.
You gotta learn to keep your mouth shut except for when you're on your knees, as he pushed into her.
Carter was next. While he was riding her, little Walter awoke and began to cry.
Shut up, kid, or I'll have to read you your rights, Mel Searles hollered,
and then laughed. Nyak, nyak, nyak. 11. It was almost midnight. Linda Everett lay fast asleep in her half of the bed. She had an exhausting day. She had an early call tomorrow. Evacuation detail, and not even her worries about Janelle could keep her awake. She didn't snore, exactly, but a soft queep, queep, queep sound came from her half of the bed. Rusty had had an equally exhausting day, but he couldn't sleep, and it wasn't Jan he was worried about. He thought she was going to be all right, at least for a while. He could keep her seizures at bay if they didn't get any worse. If he ran out of Zorontin at the hospital dispensary, he could get more from Sanders' drug. It was Dr. Haskell he kept thinking about. And Rory Dinsmore, of course. Rusty kept seeing the torn and bloody socket where the boy's eye had been. Kept hearing Ron Haskell telling Ginny, I'm not death. Deaf, I mean. Except he had been death. He rolled over in bed, trying to leave these memories behind, and what came in their place was Rory muttering, It's Halloween. Overlapping that, his own daughter's voice. It's the Great Pumpkin's fault. You have to stop the Great Pumpkin. His daughter had been having a seizure. The Dinsmore kid had taken a ricochet to the eye and a bullet fragment to the brain. What did that tell him? It tells me nothing. What did the Scottish guy say on Lost? Don't mistake coincidence for fate? Maybe that had been it. Maybe it had. But Lost had been a long time ago. The Scottish guy could have said, don't mistake fate for coincidence. He rolled over the other way and this time saw the black headline of that night's Democrat one sheet. Explosives to be fired at barrier. It was hopeless. Sleep was out of the question for now. And the worst thing you could do in a situation like that was try to flog your way into dreamland. There was half a loaf of Linda's famous cranberry orange bread downstairs. He'd seen it on the counter when he came in. Rusty decided he'd have a piece of it at the kitchen table and thumb through the latest issue of American Family Physician.
If an article on whooping cough wouldn't put him to sleep, nothing would. He got up, a big man dressed in the blue scrubs that were his usual nightwear, and left quietly, so as not to wake Linda. Halfway to the stairs, he paused and cocked his head. Audrey was whining, very soft and low, from the girls' room. Rusty went down there and eased the door open. The golden retriever, just a dim shape between the girls' beds, turned to look at him and voiced another of those low whines. Judy was lying on her side with one hand tucked under her cheek, breathing long and slow. Janny was a different story. She rolled restlessly from one side to the other, kicking at the bedclothes and muttering. Rusty stepped over the dog and sat down on her bed, under Janny's latest boy band poster. She was dreaming, not a good dream by her troubled expression, and that muttering sounded like protests. Rusty tried to make out the words, but before he could, she ceased. Audrey whined again. Jan's nightdress was all twisted. Rusty straightened it, pulled up the covers, and brushed Janny's hair off her forehead. Her eyes were moving rapidly back and forth beneath her closed lids, but he observed no trembling of the limbs, no fluttering fingers, no characteristic smacking of the lips. REM sleep rather than seizure, almost certainly. Which raised an interesting question. Could dogs also smell bad dreams? He bent and kissed Jan's cheek. When he did, her eyes opened, but he wasn't entirely sure she was seeing him. This could have been a petty mal symptom, but Rusty just didn't believe it. Audie would have been barking, he felt sure. "Go back to sleep, honey," he said.
"He has a golden baseball, Daddy."
"I know he does, honey. Go back to sleep."
"It's a bad baseball."
"No. It's good. Baseballs are good, especially golden ones."
"Oh,"
she said. "Go back to sleep."
"Okay, Daddy."
She rolled over and closed her eyes. There was a moment of settling beneath the covers, and then she was still. Audrey, who had been lying on the floor with her head up watching them, now put her muzzle on her paw and went to sleep herself. Rusty sat there a while, listening to his daughter's breathe, telling himself there was really nothing to be frightened of. People talked their way in and out of dreams all the time. He told himself that everything was fine. He only had to look at the sleeping dog on the floor if he doubted. But in the middle of the night, it was hard to be an optimist. When dawn was still long hours away, bad thoughts took on flesh and began to walk. In the middle of the night, thoughts became zombies. He decided he didn't want the cranberry orange bread after all. What he wanted was to snuggle against his bed-warm sleeping wife. But before leaving the room, he stroked Audrey's silky head. "Pay attention, girl," he whispered. Audie briefly opened her eyes and looked at him. He thought, golden retriever. And following that, the perfect connection. Golden baseball. A bad baseball. That night, despite of the girls' newly discovered feminine privacy, Rusty left their door open. 12. Lester Coggins was sitting on Rennie's stoop when Big Jim got back. Coggins was reading his Bible by flashlight. This did not inspire Big Jim with the reverence devotion, but only worsened a mood that was already bad.
"God bless you, Jim," Coggins said, standing up.
When Big Jim offered his hand, Coggins seized it in a fervent fist and pumped it.
"Bless you, too," Big Jim said gamely.
Coggins gave his hand a final hard shake and let go.
"Jim, I'm here because I've had a revelation. I asked for one last night, yea, for I was sorely troubled, and this afternoon it came. God has spoken to me, both through the scripture and through that young boy."
"The Dinsmore kid?"
Coggins kissed his clasped hands with a loud smack, and then held them skyward.
"The very same. Rory Dinsmore. May God keep him for all eternity."
"He's eating dinner with Jesus right this minute," Big Jim said automatically.
He was examining the Reverend in the beam of his own flashlight, and what he was seeing wasn't good. Although the night was cooling rapidly, sweat shone on Coggins' skin. His eyes were wide, showing too much of the whites. His hair stood out in wild curls and bumbershoots. All in all, he looked like a fellow whose gears were slipping, and might soon be stripping. Big Jim thought, this is not good.
Yes, Coggins said, I'm sure, eating the great feast, wrapped in the everlasting arms.
Big Jim thought it would be hard to do both things at the same time, but kept silent on that score.
And yet his death was for a purpose, Jim. That's what I've come to tell you.
Tell me inside, Big Jim said, and before the minister could reply, have you seen my son?
Junior, no.
How long have you been here? Big Jim flicked on the hall light, blessing the generator as he did so.
An hour, maybe a little less, sitting on the steps, reading, praying, meditating.
Rennie wondered if anyone had seen him, but did not ask. Coggins was upset already, and a question like that might upset him more. Let's go in my study, he said, and led the way, head down, lumbering slowly along in his big, flat strides. Seen from behind, he looked a bit like a bear dressed in human clothes. One who was old and slow, but still dangerous. 13. In addition to the picture of the Sermon on the Mount with his safe behind it, there were a great many plaques on the walls of Big Jim's study, commending him for various acts of community service. There was also a framed picture of Big Jim shaking hands with Sarah Palin, and another of him shaking with the big number 3, Dale Earnhardt, when Earnhardt had done a fundraiser for some children's charity at the annual Oxford Plains Crasherama. There was even a picture of Big Jim shaking hands with Tiger Woods, who had seemed like a very nice Negro. The only piece of memorabilia on his desk was a gold-plated baseball in a lucite cradle. Below it, also in lucite, was an autograph reading, To Jim Rennie, with thanks for your help in putting on the Western Maine Charity Softball Tournament of 2007. It was signed Bill Spaceman Lee. As he sat behind his desk in his high-back chair, Big Jim took the ball from its cradle and began tossing it from hand to hand. It was a fine thing to toss, especially when you were a little upset. Nice and heavy, the golden seams smacking comfortably against your palms. Big Jim sometimes wondered what it would be like to have a solid gold ball. Perhaps he would look into that when this dome business was over. Coggins seated himself on the other side of the desk, in the client's chair, the supplicant's chair, which was where Big Jim wanted him. The reverend's eyes went back and forth, like the eyes of a man watching a tennis match, or maybe a hypnotist's crystal. Now, what's this all about, Lester? Fill me in, but let's keep it short, shall we? I need to get some sleep. Got a lot to do tomorrow.
Will you pray with me first, Jim?
Big Jim smiled. It was the fierce one, although not turned up to maximum chill. At least, not yet.
Why don't you fill me in before we do that? I like to know what I'm praying about before I get knee-bound.
Lester did not keep it short, but Big Jim hardly noticed. He listened with growing dismay that was close to horror. The Reverend's narrative was disjointed and peppered with biblical quotations, but the gist was clear. He had decided that their little business had displeased the Lord enough for him to clap a big glass bowl over the whole town. Lester had prayed on what to do about this, scourging himself as he did so. The scourging might have been metaphorical, Big Jim certainly hoped so. And the Lord had led him to some Bible verse about madness, blindness, smiting, etc., etc.
The Lord said he would shoo me a sign and...
Shoo?
Big Jim raised his tufted eyebrows. Lester ignored him and plunged on, sweating like a man with malaria, his eyes still following the golden ball, back and forth.
It was like when I was a teenager, and I used to come in my bed.
Les, that's a little too much information.
Tossing the ball from hand to hand.
God said he would shoo me blindness, but not my blindness. And this afternoon, out in that field, he did... Didn't he?
Well, I guess that's one interpretation.
No!
Coggins leaped to his feet. He began to walk in a circle on the rug, his Bible in one hand. With the other, he tugged at his hair.
God said that when I saw that sign, I had to tell my congregation exactly what you'd been up to.
Just me? Big Jim asked. He did so in a meditative voice. He was tossing the ball from hand to hand a little faster now. Smack, 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 back and forth against palms that were fleshy, but still hard.
No,
Lester said in a kind of groan. He paced faster now, no longer looking at the ball. He was waving the Bible with the hand not busy trying to tear his hair out by the roots. He did the same thing in the pulpit sometimes when he really got going. That stuff was all right in church, but here, it was just plain infuriating.
It was you and me and Roger Killian, the Bowie brothers, and,
he lowered his voice,
and that other one, the chef. I think that man's crazy. If he wasn't when he started last spring, he sure is now.
Look who's talking, little buddy, Big Jim thought.
We're all involved, but it's you and I who have to confess, Jim. That's what the Lord told me.
That's what the boy's blindness meant, is what he died for. We'll confess, and we'll burn that barn of Satan behind the church. Then God will let us go.
You'll go, all right, Lester, straight to Shawshank State Prison.
I will take the punishment God metes out, and gladly.
And me, Andy Sanders, the Bowie brothers, and Roger Killian, he's got, I think, 9 kids to support. What if we're not so glad, Lester?
I can't help that.
Now Lester began to whack himself on the shoulders with his Bible back and forth, first one side and then the other. Big Jim found himself synchronizing his tosses of the golden baseball to the preacher's blows. Whack. And smack. Whack. And smack. Whack. And smack.
It's sad about the Killian children, of course, but
Exodus 20, verse 5. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the 3rd and 4th generation.
We have to bow to that. We have to clean out this chancre, however much it may hurt. Make right what we have made wrong.
That means confession and purification. Purification by fire. Big Jim raised the hand not currently holding the gold baseball.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Think about what you're saying. This town depends on me, and you, of course, in ordinary times, but in times of crisis it needs us.
He stood up, pushing his chair back. This had been a long and terrible day. He was tired, and now this. It made a man angry.
We have sinned.
Coggan spoke stubbornly, still whacking himself with his Bible, as if he thought treating God's holy book like that was perfectly okay.
What we did, Les, was keep thousands of kids from starving in Africa. We even paid to treat their hellish diseases. We also built you a new church and the most powerful Christian radio station in the Northeast.
And lined our own pockets, don't forget that.
Coggins shrilled. This time he smacked himself full in the face with the good book. A thread of blood seeped from one nostril.
Lined them with filthy dope money.
He smacked himself again.
And Jesus' radio station is being run by a lunatic who cooks the poison that children put into their veins.
Actually, I think most of them smoke it.
Is that supposed to be funny?
Big Jim came around the desk. His temples were throbbing and a brick-like flush was rising in his cheeks. Yet he tried once more, speaking softly, as if to a child doing a tantrum.
Lester, the town needs my leadership. If you go opening your gob, I won't be able to provide that leadership. Not that anyone will believe you.
They'll all believe,
Coggins cried. When they see the devil's workshop I've let you run behind my church, they'll all believe.
And Jim, don't you see? Once the sin is out, once the soul's been cleansed, God will remove his barrier. The crisis will end. They won't need your leadership.
That was when James P. Rennie snapped.
They'll always need it,
he roared, and swung the baseball in his closed fist. It split the skin of Lester's left temple as Lester was turning to face him. Blood poured down the side of Lester's face. His left eye glared out of the gore. He lurched forward with his hands out. The Bible flapped at Big Jim like a blabbery mouth.
Blood pattered down onto the carpet. The left shoulder of Lester's sweater was already soaked.
No, this is not the will of the Lord.
It's my will, you troublesome fly.
Big Jim swung a